Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Born in Blackness, Africa, Africans, and the Making of the Modern World, 1471 to the Second World War, by Howard W. French. Read by James Fowey. All these words from the cellar, but not one word from the soul. The kings and captains whose words moved ships, but not one word from the cargo. Zora Neale Hurston, Barracoon. Not knowing it was hard, knowing it was harder. Toni Morrison, Beloved. Introduction. It would be unusual for a story that begins in the wrong place to arrive at the right conclusions, and so it is with the history of how what we routinely think of as the modern world was made. Traditional accounts have accorded a primacy of place to Europe's 15th century Age of Discovery, and to the long-yearned-for maritime connection it established between West and East. Paired with this historic feat sits the momentous, if accidental, find of what came to be known as the New World. Other explanations for the emergence of the modern reside in the ethics and temperament that some associate with Judeo-Christian beliefs, with the development and spread of the scientific method, or, more chauvinistically still, with Europeans' often professed belief in their unique ingenuity and inventiveness. Ideas like these have become associated in the popular imagination with the Protestant Reformation and with the strong work ethic, individualism, and entrepreneurial drive that supposedly flowed from it in places like England and Holland. There is no gainsaying the significance of the voyages of Iberians like Vasco da Gama, who reached Calicut via the Indian Ocean in 1498, Ferdinand Magellan, who traveled west to Asia, skirting the southern tip of South America, and other famous mariners of their era. This is all the more so for Christopher Columbus, even though he mistook the islands of the Caribbean for Japan and India, errors he went to his death still clinging to. As one writer has elegantly said of Columbus, when he sailed west, he had been a medieval man from a medieval world, surrounded by medieval notions about cyclops, pygmies, Amazons, dog-faced natives, antipodeans who walk on their heads and think with their feet, about dark-skinned, giant-eared races who inhabit the lands where gold and precious gems grow. When he stepped onto American soil, however, he did more than enter a new world. He stepped into a new age. But however common in the popular imagination, the commencement of modern history with these most famous of feats of discovery, presented as if to be viewed on a trapeze in the center ring of a three-ring circus, obscures the true beginnings of the story of how the globe became permanently stitched together and thus became modern. It also so dramatically miscasts the role of Africa that it becomes a profound mistelling. The first impetus for the Age of Discovery was not Europe's yearning for ties with Asia, as so many of us have been taught in grade school, but rather its centuries-old desire to forge trading ties with legendarily rich black societies hidden away somewhere in the heart of darkest West Africa. Iberia's most famous sailors cut their teeth not seeking routes to Asia, but rather plying the coastline of West Africa. This is where they perfected techniques of map-making and navigation, where Spain and Portugal experimented with improved ship designs, and where Columbus came to understand the functioning of Atlantic Ocean winds and currents well enough so that he would later be able to reach the western limits of the sea with a confidence that no European had previously had before him of being able to return home. Well before he mounted his expeditions on behalf of Spain, Columbus, an Italian from Genoa, had sailed to provision Europe's first large, fortified overseas outpost in the tropics at Elmina, in modern-day Ghana. Europe's expeditions to West Africa of the mid-15th century were bound up in a search for the sources of that region's prodigious wealth in gold. Indeed, it was the huge trade in this precious metal, discovered by the Portuguese in 1471 and secured by the building of the fort at Elmina in 1482, that helped fund Da Gama's later mission of discovery to Asia. This helped make it possible for Lisbon, until then the seat of a small and impecunious European crown, to steal a march on its neighbors and radically alter the course of world history. Bartolomeo Diaz, another habitué of Elmina, rounded Africa's Cape of Good Hope in 1488, proving the existence of a sea route to what would become known as the Indian Ocean. But no onward voyage to Asia would even be attempted for nearly a decade after that, when Da Gama finally sailed to Calicut. The teaching of history about this era of iconic discoveries is confoundingly silent, not only on that decade, but on the nearly three decades from the Portuguese arrival at Elmina until their landing in India. It was this moment when Europe and what is nowadays styled sub-Saharan Africa came into permanent deep contact that laid the foundations of the modern age. Although fundamental to understanding how today's world was built, this elision is merely one of numerous examples in a centuries-long process of diminishment, trivialization, and erasure of Africans and of people of African descent from the story of the modern world. A central aim of Born in Blackness is to restore key chapters like these to their proper place of prominence in our common narrative of modernity. Although often obscure, most of what is written here does not consist of freshly discovered information. In reality, history seldom works that way. Rather, siloed and piecemeal, the facts that I relate have been silenced or repeatedly swept into dark corners. Of central concern in this book is the deeply twinned and tragic history of Africa and Europe that began with geopolitical collisions in the 15th century. Events and activities that flowed from Afro-European encounters set the most Atlantic-oriented Europeans onto a path that would eventually propel their continent past the great civilizational centers of Asia and the Islamic world in both wealth and power. This ascension was not founded upon any innate or permanent European characteristics that produced superiority. To a degree that remains unrecognized, it was built on the foundation of Europe's economic and political relations with Africa. The heart of the matter here, of course, was the massive, centuries-long transatlantic trade in slaves, who were put to work by the millions growing sugar, tobacco, cotton, and other cash crops on the plantations of the New World. The long thread that leads us to the present began precisely in the elided decades mentioned earlier, when commercial linkages blossomed between Portugal and Africa, sending a newfound prosperity washing over what had previously been a marginal European country, a prosperity that would become the very mother's milk of modernity. It drove urbanization there on an unprecedented scale, and created new, modern identities that were gradually freed from the previously unbreakable feudal ties to the land. Indeed, one of these novel identities was nationhood, as we understand it in the contemporary sense of the word, and the dawning of this kind of consciousness was bound up in questing for wealth in faraway lands, and soon thereafter, in emigration and in colonization in the tropics. As Portugal ventured out into the world in the early 15th century, and for nearly a century this meant almost exclusively the world of Africa, its people were among the first to make another conceptual leap. They began to think of discovery not merely as the simple act of stumbling upon assorted novelties or arriving wide-eyed in never-before-visited places, but rather as something new and more abstract, Discovery became a mindset, and this would become another cornerstone of modernism. It meant understanding that the world was infinite in its social complexity, and this required a broadening of consciousness, even amid the colossal violence and horror that accompanied this process, and an ever more systematic unmooring from provincialism. Modernity, to be sure, remains a deeply contested term, one given to many, often contradictory interpretations. In a book that will make strong claims about Africa's unheralded role in its emergence, therefore, it is perhaps appropriate to weigh in right here with a kind of functional definition. In writing about modernity, the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor has postulated two very different notions of what people mean by this term, one cultural and the other acultural. We will eventually employ both of these usages, but here, it is the cultural vision of modernity that concerns us most. In that take, he writes, we can look at the difference between present-day Western society and, say, that of medieval Europe, as analogous to the difference between medieval Europe and medieval China or India. In other words, we can think of the difference as one between civilizations, each with their own culture. Drawing on Taylor's notion, Born in Blackness will show that the fateful engagement between Europe and sub-Saharan Africa, which began in the early 15th century, and then rapidly accelerated and deepened toward that century's end and beyond, produced civilizational transformations in both of these regions as well as in the wider world, ones that, looking back today, produced, like few other things ever have, a crisp division between before and after. Back then, Europeans were themselves mindful of this reality. As late as the 1530s, which is to say, well after the commencement of Portugal's more famous spice trade with Asia, Lisbon still recognized Africa as the leading driver of all that was new. João de Barros, a counselor to that country's crown, for example, wrote, I do not know in this kingdom a yoke of land, toll, tithe, excise, or any other royal tax more reliable than the profits of commerce in Guinea. But as remarkable as Barros's acknowledgement of African vitality was, his omission of slavery as a pillar of the relationship may have been the first time that the centrality of black bondage to epical social and economic change was denied or simply passed over in an informed account of the experience of modernity in the West. It would not be the last. When Barros wrote, Portugal overwhelmingly dominated Europe's trade in Africans, and slavery was beginning to rival gold as Portugal's most lucrative source of African bounty. By then, it was already on its way to becoming the foundation of a new economic system based on plantation agriculture that over time would generate far more wealth for Europe than African gold, or for that matter, Asia's famously coveted silks and spices. Sounding like an updated Barros, Malachi Postlethwaite, a leading 18th century British expert on commerce, called the rents and revenues of plantation slave labor the fundamental prop and support of his country's prosperity and social effervescence. The British Empire, then in full flower, he described as a magnificent superstructure of American commerce and naval power built on an African foundation. Around the same time, an equally prominent French thinker, Guillaume Thomas François du Raynal, described Europe's plantations worked by African slaves the principal cause of the rapid motion which now agitates the universe. Daniel Defoe, the English author of Robinson Crusoe, but also a trader, pamphleteer, and spy, bested them both when he wrote, No African trade, no Negroes. No Negroes, no sugars, gingers, indicos, etc. No sugar, etc. No islands, no continent. No continent, no trade. Postlethwaite, Raynal, and Defoe were surely right, even if they were far from comprehending all of the reasons why. As this book will make clear, more than any other part of the world, Africa has been the linchpin of the machine of modernity. Without African peoples trafficked from its shores, the Americas would have counted for little in the ascendance of the West. African labor in the form of slaves became the providential factor that made the very mise en valeur or development of the Americas possible. Without it, Europe's colonial projects in the New World, such as we know them, are simply unimaginable. Through the development of plantation agriculture and a succession of history-altering commercial crops, tobacco, coffee, cacao, indigo, rice, and above all, sugar, Europe's deep and often brutal ties with Africa drove the birth of a truly global capitalist economy. Slave-grown sugar hastened the coming together of the processes we call industrialization. It radically transformed diets, making possible much higher worker productivity. And in doing so, sugar completely revolutionized European society. As readers will discover, this includes playing a critical but largely uncredited role in the anchoring of democracy on that continent. In sugar's wake, cotton grown by slaves in the American South helped launch formal industrialization along with an immense second wave of consumerism. After plentiful calories, abundant and varied clothing for the masses became a reality for the first time in human history. As revealed here, the scale and the scope of the American antebellum cotton boom, which made this possible, were nothing short of astonishing. This made the value derived from the trade and ownership of slaves in America alone, as distinct from the cotton and other products they produced, greater than that of all of the country's factories, railroads, and canals combined. Born in Blackness is, in part, an account of forgotten European contests over control of the African bounty that built the modern world. Spain and Portugal waged fierce naval battles in West Africa over access to gold. Holland and Portugal, then unified with Spain, fought something little short of a world war in the 17th century, with control of trade in the richest sources of slaves in Africa, present-day Congo and Angola, flipping back and forth between them. On the far side of the Atlantic, Brazil, the biggest producer of slave-grown sugar in the early 17th century, was caught up in this same struggle and repeatedly changed hands. Later in that same century, England fought Spain over control of the Caribbean. Why did faraway powers contend so fiercely over such things? Tiny Barbados provides an answer. By the mid-1660s, just 3 decades or so after England initiated an African slave labor model for its plantations there, one that was first implemented in the Portuguese colony of São Tomé little more than a century earlier, sugar from Barbados was worth more than the metal exports of all of Spanish America. As much as this book is a story of classical military struggle for control of the richest plantation lands and the most prolific sources of slaves, and of the economic miracles they produced at different stages of this history, it is also an account of another kind of conflict altogether, both unconventional and ceaseless, a war on blacks themselves. It is one that, very conservatively speaking, continued at least until the end of Jim Crow in America, where this book concludes. This involved the consistent pursuit of strategies to beat Africans into submission, enslave one another, to recruit blacks as proxies and auxiliaries, whether to secure territories from native populations of the New World or joust with European rivals in the Americas. To say this is not to deprive Africans of agency, a question that will be taken up at length in this book. The impact of this warfare on Africa's subsequent development, another wage of modernity, however, has been immeasurable. Nowadays, the consensus estimate on the number of Africans brought to the Americas hovers around 12 million. Lost in this atrocious but far too neat accounting is the likelihood that another 6 million Africans were killed in or near their homelands during the hunt for slaves before they could be placed in chains. Estimates vary, but between 5% and 40% perished during brutal overland treks to the coast, or while being held, often for months, in barracoons or holding pens as they awaited embarkation on slave ships. And another 10% of those who were taken aboard died at sea during an Atlantic transit that constituted an extreme mental and physical test for all those who were subjected to it. When one considers that Africa's total population in the mid-19th century was probably around 100 million, one begins to gauge the enormity of the demographic assault that the slave trade represented. This war on black people raged just as fiercely on the western shores of the Atlantic as did the resistance, and these, too, we must reckon with here. In most of the New World plantation societies, the average remaining lifespan of trafficked blacks was reckoned at 7 years or less. In 1751, an English planter on Antigua summed up the prevailing slave owner sentiment this way. It was cheaper to work slaves to the utmost, and by the little fare and hard usage, to wear them out before they become useless and unable to do service, and then to buy new ones to fill up their places. Born in Blackness takes us all the way to the penultimate stages of this war, with the story of how Big Cotton burst forth in late 18th century America, creating a unique fusion of bookkeeping and brutality. In 1808, a typical picker in South Carolina, then still the heart of America's cotton-growing region, averaged 28 pounds per day of harvest. By 1846, the average Mississippi cotton picker delivered up 341 pounds to his masters, a rate of increase fully in step with the growth of factory productivity in Manchester. In creating this account, it was important for me to be able to locate as many of the physical traces of the history covered herein as possible, and to breathe the air and tread the ground where many of the events and processes described transpired. I was aided in this by the remarkable degree of coincidence, here and there, between the places written about and with my own life, meaning both biographical details bound up in family history and in my 4-decade-long career as a journalist and writer. Almost everyone who reads this book is somehow a product of the histories explored here. But as the child of two African-American parents of mixed and diverse heritage, I am especially conscious of this. I am fortunate to know quite a bit about my family, especially on my late mother's side, which has old and clearly traceable roots in slavery in Virginia, including the kind of involuntary racial mixing made most famous by Thomas Jefferson, and indeed in the case of my ancestors, involving a friend of America's third president who designed his home. This account will close with a meditation on what that has meant to me and how it shaped this narrative. I was lucky to be introduced to Africa while still a university student, first as an enthralled visitor during college breaks, and later living there for 6 years following graduation. I cut my teeth as a journalist writing about Africa and traveling widely, and I married a woman who had grown up in Côte d'Ivoire, but whose family hails from a nearby part of Ghana. I wasn't at all aware of it at the time, but it was within a few miles of her ancestral village that Europeans first stumbled upon the abundant sources of West African gold that they had been searching for feverishly for several decades in the 15th century. It was a discovery that changed the world. I left West Africa to join the staff of the New York Times in 1986. Some 3 years later, My first assignment as a foreign correspondent for the paper was to cover the Caribbean basin. Here were gathered some of the most important staging areas for subsequent global transformations of the First Order. Specialists aside, few imagine that islands like Barbados and Jamaica were far more important in their day than were the English colonies that would become the United States. The nation now known as Haiti, even more so. In the 18th century, it became the richest colony in history, and in the 19th, by dint of its slave population's successful revolution, Haiti rivaled the United States in terms of its influence on the world, notably in helping fulfill the most fundamental Enlightenment value of all, ending slavery. Now and then during my time in the Caribbean, I could see glimmers of this region's extraordinary meta-narrative. These came when I stood knee-deep in the heavily silted seawater, witnessing an archaeological dig in the Dominican Republic that sought to identify a wreck from Columbus's first voyage, or when I hiked a verdant peak in northern Haiti. There, Henri Christophe, that country's early black leader, built the formidable Citadelle La Ferrière, the largest fortress in the Western Hemisphere, arming it with 365 cannons to defend the country's hard-won independence from France. Other hints came when I wandered into the mountains and rainforests of Jamaica and Suriname, respectively, and was thrilled to be able to make myself understood speaking bits of Twi, the lingua franca of Ghana, learned while courting my wife, as I spoke with the descendants of proud runaway slave communities known as Maroons. But back then, I still had no big picture in mind. Like most correspondents, I was too busy following the news to pursue sweeping historical connections very far. Later, I was sent back to West Africa by the Times. In a handful of years there in the late 1990s, I spent large amounts of time in the Sahel, the site of the medieval African Empire building discussed herein, and in the coastal bloodlands that fed the slave trade most heavily. I went into this project already well aware of the silence and enforced ignorance that surround the central contribution of Africa and of Africans in the making of the modern world that we all inhabit today. But I was not prepared for how difficult it can be in place after place to access some of the physical traces of this history, or to find local forms of remembrance and commemoration that raise this African role to its proper dimension. I have seen this in a great many places that have profoundly marked our common history, in countries like Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where the publicly established sites of Atlantic memory are few. I saw it in Sao Tome, the island where the slave plantation complex model that would dominate history in the Western Hemisphere and drive wealth creation in the North Atlantic for four centuries was perfected, a fact for which there is nary a plaque or commemoration. In Salvador, the capital of Bahia, the blackest and most slavery-marked area of the rich Portuguese colony's entire history, I hired a black Brazilian guide who had come highly recommended. But when we met face to face, and I specified that I wanted to tour plantation ruins and visit rural communities that descended from runaway slaves, she was nonetheless taken aback. "I never imagined that people could be interested in sugar plantations," she said, explaining that in years of business she had never received such a request. My biggest surprise, though, came in Barbados, whose slave-produced sugar, arguably more than any other place on earth, helped seal England's ascension in the 17th century. I disembarked on the island in March 2019, determined to find as many traces of this legacy as possible, only to discover how thoroughly they had been hidden or effaced. Among my top priorities was to visit one of the largest slave cemeteries anywhere in the hemisphere, including the excavated remains of nearly 600 people. It took me several efforts spread over 3 days, though, to even locate the cemetery, which had no signage from any public road. Conversations with residents of the area, whom I repeatedly importuned, made clear that very few were aware of its historical importance or even of its existence. All I discovered when I...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?